right, what's up, everybody? We're live here in Arizona with another Mojo Sessions. We've got Larry from Live Case Break, one of the OG breakers in the hobby. We're going to chat about the beginning days. We're going to talk about cards, and we're just going to have a fun conversation. So thanks for tuning in here on Mojo Break Media. Make sure you hit that subscribe button for all the latest hobby content. Larry, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Not much. I'm doing great. Happy to be out here in Arizona. The weather's a lot drier than it is at home in Miami.
Nice.
Thanks for having me.
Definitely.
It's a beautiful day. I mean, I wish we could actually turn the camera around and get the backdrop. Beautiful pool. Not a cloud in the sky. Well, a little bit of clouds, but, you know.
A little humid out here.
A little humid.
It's so funny. The subjectivity of humidity.
Yes. When you come from California, anywhere is more humid.
It's not Florida.
Yeah. So, man, did you ever think that this industry would be where it is today, 10 years ago?
Never. I mean, we started this out. My kid wanted to collect Cam Newton cards, and I was trying to find a better way to, you know, get Cam Newton cards without spending $200 a box, you know, and then we started doing breaking, and to see that we're here, you know, doing this now, and so many years later is crazy to me.
So how did it start? What gave you guys the idea to, I mean, obviously you got your Cam Newton cards, but, like, what really prompted you guys to start the business?
I just thought, once I saw what a break was, and at that time there were not many people breaking, it was very new, and at that time I think it was Chris Justice. I don't think it was live. I think you had to, like, trust him. He would show the serial number of the box. You would be able to buy a team.
Yep.
And I didn't understand why it wasn't live and why it was only one box.
Right.
That was part. I was just like, we could do this. You know, we could do this. And from there, it just went from collecting Cam Newton cards to looking at, like, okay, this is a business that is possible. And then balancing that with my, you know, legal career was a challenge, and still is a challenge. But it's always great when you can do something you love, and that becomes a way to actually make a living.
Absolutely.
And when you started out, were you buying product from, like, online retailers, or were you going, did you go, like, straight to a distributor? And how did you find different distributors in the industry?
Funny. We started out buying from Blowout.
Okay.
And we didn't know that there was a such thing as a distributor.
Right.
Then one of our customers was friendly with Brad Ziegler. So Brad Ziegler started breaking for us.
Yep, remember that.
And he was like, oh, let me introduce you to my friend Lloyd. He works at GTS. And we met GTS, and they've been great partners for us ever since. They've supported us in every possible way, you know, and really have always been there for me and our business.
Absolutely.
What do you think some of the biggest challenges were back then that maybe breakers don't face now?
I think social media has changed. That's changed a lot to where, when we were doing it, anyone could just set up a camera and sit down and do it. But still reaching people, I don't think it was as easy as it is now, where there's all these places where collectors congregate. Also, when we started it, I feel like card collecting was still something that was out of an episode of The Simpsons.
Right.
It was something very that niche. Was stigmatized. Oh, you guys sell baseball cards?
Yep.
Like, I almost honestly was embarrassed, you know, when people would ask, you know, being an attorney, and people ask me, oh, what is this? And I almost felt like a little bit embarrassed to say, well, this is what I'm doing. Oh, yeah, and by the way, I'm making, you know, good money doing it. I still felt like people were judging me.
I always felt it was a hard challenge to try to explain what group breaks were, to the point where I think I just tried to give up and I tried to avoid the question at family gatherings. Did you ever have any creative ways of describing what you did?
I just try to tell people, imagine if you're a fan of one team, when you open the box, you're probably only interested in collecting the players on your team. What are you doing with the rest of them? They're probably sitting in a box in your house, or eventually get thrown away. Imagine if you didn't ever have to do that and you would only pay for what you used.
Sure.
And so it's just kind of, I always explained it like that you're only paying for what you use.
You can really pinpoint your collection that way. And I've done the same exact thing, especially with PYTs. And we still do about a majority of our breaks with PYTs. I think you guys, that's kind of your bread and butter as well. We run ours as, like, a reverse auction, which I feel gives us a little bit more control of the margins and stuff like that. So I know you guys have always been PYT-based.
The challenge is pricing, right? The challenge is pricing.
The challenge is pricing. The magic eight ball. Like, what does this team go for?
Well, and then you have those customers that you know are looking for your pricing mistakes. You're like, I missed that one.
Yeah, I missed that one.
You can tell right when they sell right away. And that's a good question too, is how do you guys pull your data to determine how to price teams out? What are you using? Are you just knowing the rookies or?
I look, sometimes the checklist is not out yet. I try to wait for the checklist. And honestly, I mean, the truth is, I do mine, and I look at yours, yep. I look at Rich's, and I see, am I missing something? You know, I always do mine first, and then compare, and then see, okay, is someone in a product I didn't know about? Yep. Did I overlook something? Am I just way off base? And we try to also eBay, repeated auctions, sometimes people
tell us about. For sure. That definitely helps. Yeah, and like with football, you know what rookies are going to be in the product. Football's a little bit easier. Baseball's tricky. You don't know really what prospects are going to be in certain products. You don't know what rookies are going to be in certain products. So, but the lineage like that you have, like the Yankees, you know the Yankees are always going to be a top-tier team. You know the Red Sox are always going to be a top-tier team. Right. But football, I think, is probably one of the...
I think football and basketball are probably very similar,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, basketball, the rookie you classes, also have like the rookie photo shoot that you can pull from. For sure.
Yeah, and then I do a lot of DFS, daily fantasy sports, so I just have a lot more football knowledge. Football is easier, I think, to price.
Yeah.
Offensive players are the only ones that are really going to sell.
Quarterback based, yeah.
Now, do you guys like put your stuff in like a spreadsheet ahead of time, or do you just kind of go for it?
Luckily, I have Ron that works with us. He is
great
a
guy.
Guru,
yeah.
A great guy and a guru at creating these spreadsheets for someone, you know, old like me that's not the,
right.
not the most tech savvy. He creates these amazing idiot-proof spreadsheets where it's only right in the green. Only change the green. Do not touch anything that's not in the green.
Right.
So I put one number in and then he has percentages. Like, he has all these formulas that are built into these sheets where it just makes really, really easy for me not to mess up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as I stay in the green.
Yeah.
Exactly. If I write outside the green areas, I get in big trouble.
Yeah. I mean, we've been doing it long enough. I mean, both all of us, that there was no roadmap for us to follow. I think the breakers that are coming up now, even like 5 years ago, we kind of, not to toot our own horn, but we kind of paved this path for everybody to basically like, this is how you do it. This is how you do it the right way. This is what to do. This is what not to do. Like we took the lumps.
There was no one to teach that. And you know, look, think about how many of your customers are breaking operations now.
I always say
we gave birth to totally different breaking operations.
Well, you know? And it's funny because I've mentioned this before on the podcast is that I think like when we started it, we never thought it would be like, I didn't think I'd be able to quit my job. It was more of like a hobby, and it's fun. We'll do it like once a week. Now I think unfortunately, you have guys that come in with the money signs on their mind, right? And I think that's always like the wrong way to look at it. I mean, obviously you have to make money as a business, but at the same time, you also have to make it fair. There's that fine balance where I feel like, you know, you go on like, not to rip on like Whatnot or Loop, but you see these guys doing like these repacks where they're not even numbered and they're auctioned and it's just... Yeah, just like I don't think any of the older guys that have been around that started the way that we did would do something like that where it's not transparent, right?
That's part of the thing I don't understand about the hobby right now is that I don't like when I watch some of this stuff on Whatnot or you know even on Facebook Live, and I see and I you know we have it's kind of like we have the cheat codes. We know what the cost of these products are. Mm-hmm. We know what we're making out of a break, and you see what these people are charging. I don't understand how the market is not regulating that.
Yeah.
I don't understand how the market is not saying, this is not a good deal for me. People are just patronizing these operations. It's very weird to me that the market has not said, okay, this is not value. You know, value is unfortunately not a factor right now in today's hobby. I think that's really, value is not an important driver.
Yeah, I mean, there's things that I see that blow my mind. Like, one, there's a breaking operation that they'll put together a mixer, but they sell the spots beforehand. And then however much money they take in...
They sell the spots
And then they build the break.
Like, you don't even know what products you're getting until it's sold out.
So then they build the break after the fact. And they're like, don't worry, it's going to be a great deal. It's going to be...
Value is not a fact... This is, I mean, and again, it could be generational differences. Like, this is, value is not a variable in what the modern collector is evaluating when they're deciding to purchase cards, mm-hmm. or just products or break spots or anything. And that's like, I just...
Well, and I think that's, because I compare some of my own spending habits. You know, I'll buy stuff on Instagram if it's one click and I don't have to think.
Yeah.
You know, I'll buy a shirt that I maybe didn't need, or I buy a collectible I didn't need. So I kind of look at these whatnots and these loops, and like, I know it's great that it's all there, but I think that's what you're getting. Because I mean, with our website and your guys' website, you have to go to PayPal, come back. So there's that thing like, do I really want this team or should I not buy this team? I think there's a lot more thought of like, do I really want to buy into this?
So you're really going after the impulse.
Right. Players. So I think these guys that are buying, like what you mentioned, with the guy that's not even saying what he has, it's such a one-click thing that they don't have any time to think. And that's good for the seller, but I think at the same time as people in the hobby, they need to be more informed and maybe know what they're buying before they...
Well, those are the people that, unfortunately, will probably end up getting burnt out relatively quick.
Yes.
They come in, they spend a bunch of money, and then 3 months down the road, they look at what they've received for that, and they're like... Then the value hits them, and they're like... Okay, I loved doing this, but now I'm out.
Yeah, it's a negative collector experience.
Exactly.
We're here at the Topps conference, listening, if you read between the lines of what they were saying, mm-hmm. that's a little bit of the messages I'm seeing, is that they are not going to continue to allow things to happen that create a negative collector experience.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's what I got saying.
Yeah, I get that.
So I think that we could be seeing, they're going to, it sounded to me, and like I said, they didn't say anything that expressly said this. It sounded like what they were saying is they were going to put more controls on where a product is going in order to eliminate, or in order to protect the positive collector experience.
Yeah, and I know we've even kicked around like Better Business Bureau ideas. I don't know if that's the right way to do it, but like just to know, like give consumer confidence on who to buy right now, because with Whatnot and Loop and these websites, you don't have to have any skin in the game to jump on these sometimes. I know with Loop, I think there's a little bit more of approval process. Whatnot might have it, but like you just see what these guys are buying, and it's like I don't think these guys that are breaking have your long-term investment in mind.
Well, they don't. I always say, yeah, we have a nice company. We have, you know, the thing we created is a community. That's the thing. You know, these people got together and are friends that, you know, we have people all over the world that actually care about what's happening in mm-hmm. each other's lives. It's not really just, let me sell you some cards.
Right. Yeah.
You know, customers has a death in the family. They have questions about probate. Mm-hmm. They call me, you know. People celebrate kids graduating. You know, through Facebook also, like, people are vested in each other's real lives.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's what I like about our business, what we created in doing this. But I don't know that that's being created in these newer operations. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're making tons of money, and they're churning tons, huge amounts of product, and they're buying it at above retail.
Yeah, right? I mean,
that's the game.
Yeah, I mean, they're buying it from online retailers that are selling it for a lot more than what we're getting it for.
What are distributors? I mean, look, the distributors are pretty much retailers now.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes, and these, you know, newer breakers are eating that stuff up. They're gobbling the product up. And look, they're not, and it's not a charity. They're passing it on to the end mm-hmm. consumer at even a higher price.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned distribution, and I know you probably are feeling some of the effects that we're feeling with, you know, getting less and less product as the years go by.
Yes.
What are your hopes with, you know, Fanatics taking over? Assuming, you know, the distributorship does stay the same, there might be a few changes. What would you like to see for the way that they distribute the product?
I'd honestly be happy if it stayed the way it is now and didn't keep moving in a negative direction for us.
Yeah.
You know, I would be happy to have some confidence that, okay, I'm going to get this much product. I can break it. My customers can expect that I'll have it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, on some things, we're down to less than a case on football.
And it's crazy
basketball.
Because you go back 5, 6, 7 years, and
were begging us to take more.
You would never think that our major hurdle that we have would be getting product, because that would never even went through our mind. It was like, you want National Treasures?
How much?
Like, you can just keep on. And, I mean, we would basically get a case, and then the next day,
we need two more.
Yeah, get another case. And it was like, almost like the distributor was like an off-site warehouse that we were just pulling from. Now you look at it and you're just like, it's like pulling teeth trying to get, like, you have three boxes. Well, if you give me like one more box,
can I get one more box?
Like,
yeah.
So
yes, you can get $1 more, but it's 20% more than retail.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I almost feel like could they bridge, like, you use like Flawless Basketball for an example, and I believe the wholesale was like $5,000 or $6,000, which nobody really got it at that much. But then the needle moves to $30,000. Of course, distributors are like, I'm not going to sell it to anybody at $6,000.
I get it. Like, they are.
Is there
also
a way to like bridge that gap? I mean, I know Topps has kind of done that a little bit more so than Panini has, but it's like, maybe if there's like a gap to bridge that we all could get more, and you know.
The only way they're going to solve the problems they were talking about at this conference is by the manufacturers exacting more control as to where the product is going.
Right. Mm.
Controlling where the product goes. Right now, they really have no
control. They have no control. Yeah.
You know, so controlling where, and look, really, it's only about controlling where the hobby product goes. I mean, I think that the base card boom is over.
Yeah.
So, like, the retail product, while it's still good and it's great entry point, like they were saying, for people to get into to the collectability of stuff, I think the hobby product is, I don't see another solution for them. I don't really see another solution as to how they're going to eliminate negative collector experiences.
Yeah.
And look, we're making a huge assumption that the experience that these people are having with these newer breakers and whatnot is negative.
Yeah.
It could be having a positive collector experience.
Yeah.
If it were me as the collector, I would say it's negative, but it could be that they find that experience to be positive.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what do you think about, like, you know, I've heard some rumblings saying, like, just take away, like, the parallels from retail and only put them in hobby and just make retail, like, a base brand.
I always hated that. You know, going back to our earlier question, we talked about how did I get back, you know, back in, because we all have the story. Mm-hmm. We're collecting, we stopped collecting, got married, did other stuff, and then came back to collecting. I mean, I don't think almost all breakers, I think everybody has that period of time that they stopped collecting.
Yeah.
So, like, I started getting back into, like, retail. And another thing I hated is that back 2009, 2008, you couldn't get anything hardly in retail.
Sure,
it was
horrible. Yeah.
So I think that's in a lot of stuff sitting on shelves. It's gonna. I think you have to create a chase.
Yeah.
For it, the Willy Wonka ticket is a real phenomenon.
Yeah.
I think you have to have that. I think that's one of the great things Topps did with Series 1 this year. It's like, it's clear they made a lot more.
Right.
But it's the strong price wise, the secondary market is the strongest Series 1 has ever been, I think, at any time ever. And they did a really good job of planting these chase cards in. Cut signature Jackie Robinson. I just got this one of one hand drawn sketch. You know, we pulled a Ty Cobb one. It was awesome. Yeah, they did a really good job at planting those Easter eggs in the product.
So, with no baseball and more production, why do you think this product is so hot?
Well, Topps.
Yeah.
I don't even know. The Wanda Franco crazes. Is Strasburg-esque. It's very reminiscent of
that. Do you think it's maybe 2020? I mean, just nobody was there. Like, Joe Adell wasn't as exciting. I mean, there wasn't really a big-name rookie. Now we're getting a taste of an in-demand rookie that's driving it. But it's like, I felt like with the lack of baseball, there wouldn't be as much crossover that
I think some of the innovative, like, inserts that they've added, like the short prints that was in Home Field Advantage, which is similar to the downtown, like, similar. But that, I think, also added, like you were saying, extra chase and stuff that you can pull in, like, a retail. Like, and I agree with you. Like, let's not make retail where you're basically only going to get base cards and you're never going to have any chase. You've got to have that chase.
Yeah.
Like retail exclusive parallels that do really well on the secondary market.
But do we want people to continue to flip retail in the future, or do we want it to just be readily available?
But if people are flipping retail, then that means the hobby SKUs are going also through the roof.
Should be, yeah.
So, I mean, they kind of work with each other. So
I think the lineups in Walmart and Target is a very bad look for the hobby.
I think that's really bad.
So they've got to come up with a way, and it's very hard. I mean, Josh was saying, he goes, look, there's no easy solution to this problem. He goes, other than pricing. But then, okay, if you price higher, they're ostensibly going to sell it to Target and Walmart higher. Mm-hmm. They may not be interested at that price point. They may not be interested because, look, there's cards is a huge theft area for them. Now they're probably spending $7 or whatever a blaster. You know, they're going to spend $30 or $35 a blaster. They may not be interested. And again, we're not purchasers for Walmart, Target. We don't know. But
true. And then if you throw it all online, then it's all gobbled by bots anyway. So
that's
it's so hard to really find a great solution for that.
you know. Yeah, I mean, you can try. And they've, I mean, the retailers have tried different things. I mean, they put it, like, in a lock cabinet, like, lock cabinet behind. They've done, like, the limit one per person per transaction. I mean, they've tried a bunch of different stuff. I don't know if there is a concrete, correct way to do it. But you got to give them credit for trying. So.
Yeah, I mean, Josh kind of said, he was like, look, the market's going to regulate it.
Yeah.
But we can fix some of it by pricing.
Yeah.
You know, we can fix some of it.
But like you're saying, like, if it doesn't financially make sense for the Target and Walmart and the margin's not there, then their purchasing manager will just start going, well, we're gonna put candy there, or we're going to put, like, something else there. And fill it. They're not going to have any issue filling up that retail spot.
But it's right in the front of the store. I mean, it's valuable shelf space.
Yeah,
right.
So it's really interesting. I don't know how they're going to fix that. It's having people lining up overnight for cards is not, I don't know that that's a good look for the hobby. But then again, sneakers, it's been years and years. They haven't changed it.
Yeah.
But I mean, and we were joking about it. Like, at one point during the pandemic with the retail SKUs, it was like Target and Walmart were handing out $100 bills to everybody.
For sure.
So you understand why people were lined 30, 40 people.
And there was people that weren't, you know, working at the time, you know, so.
So, I mean, anytime you're giving away free money, you're going to bring a mass of people.
Well, and I know when we opened our latest shop, and it was right after the pandemic, right at the beginning of the pandemic as well, that you would have people coming in and they'd be like, how much for that select box? And you'd be like, you know, the mark, and we're always under blowout. We'd be like, hey, it's $1,100. They're like, well, I can get it for $100. And I think there was a lack of education on the fact that there's retail.
Hobby, that's retail. Exactly.
Right. So
it's,
I'm like, so my roundabout way of getting to this question was, do you think that they could put, like, some kind of info card in the packs to say, hey, this is our retail, but there's a hobby version? I mean, I don't know if then that would be only directing sales to them, right?
I feel like that's against their interest. Remember, they're, like, I listened really closely to what they were saying in the morning session, and I think, like, they're really hyper-focused on collector experience, collector entry, expanding the base of collectors. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be doing whatever they can to get people into this hobby. I think they are going to use their data, their people, to grow the base of the hobby, which should be good for everybody.
Yeah.
But I also think they're going to have to start focusing on negative collector experiences. As much as they want to get people in the hobby, people also leave the hobby when they have a bad collector experience.
Yeah. What do you think is the next category to pop? We've seen F1 go through the roof. We've seen soccer was doing really well.
Wrestling is starting to get a lot of interest.
Yeah.
You know, AEW is really overtaking overtaking WWE, it seems like. And the older wrestlers, I mean, think wrestling when we were kids, during the heyday of trading cards, wrestling was the biggest.
Right.
And you guys do Pokemon and
we do Pokemon.
Like,
I don't we do it. We sell it. We sell a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I don't understand it as well as I maybe should. I didn't collect it. It's past my age group. I don't. Yeah, I know Charizard. You know, I know Pikachu.
Pikachu.
Same way. Yeah, same way. That's why I hired younger people.
Jigglypuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I have two teenage kids. They know a lot more about it than I do, and they help, you know, monitor that. We just opened our new shop in South Florida. My son helps me run it. He's 20 now, so thankfully he is in the know of these things. And
what are your guys' hours?
We're open from not really 9:30, but our post hours 10 to like 6 o'clock. Weekdays, 9 to 1 on Saturdays.
Nice. What have you seen in your shop now that you're experiencing, like, face-to-face commerce? What is something that surprised you compared to the online experience?
How many people don't know about cards?
Wow.
People that come in just out of curiosity and they're like, what is this? And then, like, they ask, how much is this box? And you tell them, oh, it's $400. And they're like, they put it down really, really fast. The price and like, they're aware of this. The price entry point for someone who is not into collecting is very high.
And how many calls a week do you get on people selling their 80s cards?
None yet. But I'm sure they will come.
I think we get a couple a day.
Do you guys have any strategies on what you decide to buy, or you're looking at everything?
Yeah,
or
right now, the town that we're in, and because, you know, we just opened, they were really actually very sensitive about opening a store where we were advertising that we were buying. They would run into, you'd have an extra bond, pawnbroker's license, all
maybe
this
stuff. Secondhand dealer license.
So we've kind of steered away from, you know, if I'm gonna buy you know, on Facebook and other stuff, but actually like walking by, I'm still a little nervous to be being set up or whatever, because it was a very big point of emphasis for them to, about are you going to be buying things from the public.
Yeah, so the one thing we do is that we only buy cards that are graded to basically get away from people bringing in shoe boxes of like 19
that's a good filter.
89 tops, and
that's a really good suggestion.
So yeah, I mean, if it's worth getting graded, it's probably gonna be worth purchasing. So
then you have to take it a step further, because we had a guy bring in like a Black Mamba grading slab, and I'm like, well, we only buy PSA BGS SGC exactly, the diamond thing. Yeah. So you know, hey, it's graded, and I'm not buying that one. So you know, that's one way we kind of. And then they'll still pry, like, what? And then how do I get rid of my card? It's like, well, try Craigslist. You can go on eBay, you know. Don't want to try to tell them to go to our competitor, but, you know, there's different ways.
You know, in my practice, we do a lot of probate work. It's like 95% of what I do. So in estates, invariably multiple times a year, there'll be someone who goes, oh, we have these sports card tools. You know, these almost always they're worth.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Yeah. You always say, like, is it from the 90s? It's like probably not worth anything.
Or actually, you go, is it from the 90s or the 80s? Or like, it's from the 80s, and they think they have something really great. Like, they're like,
it's 30 something years old.
It's vintage.
I got a dumpster in the parking lot. I'll let you throw it away for free.
Yeah.
Then the best is like when, like in those situations where you don't want to buy it, and they accuse you of trying to rip them off.
Yes.
Because you don't want to buy it.
Yeah. They think you're trying to get over on them. Like, what do you mean it's not worth anything? Well, how much do you have to offer me? Like, I don't want to offer you anything.
I really don't. I'm so sorry.
Yep.
So, Brilliant Stars is probably doing pretty well in the shop.
We sold out of it in one day.
Wow.
We sold out of it in one day. I left. We sold out of it Friday and was gone. And hopefully, we'll be able to get some more. But that's the most in-demand Pokemon product that I've had since we've been doing Pokemon probably about, well, since we opened our other store. We've been doing it, I guess, probably 3 years. This is by far the most in demand I've ever seen Pokemon. So maybe that's the next sector. Maybe Pokemon is going to blow up.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, if you would have asked me even 2 years ago, would you be selling Pokemon? I'd be like, nah. I'm like, it's just not our deal. Again, like, I don't know anything about it. It's hard to sell something you don't know about. Like, I've done a little bit of research, but still, like,
I can't relate. I can't relate to it. I don't know how to play the game.
I mean, I know.
It's based on a game. Like, yeah. I don't know how to play.
I know there's foiled parallels that are...
Yeah, and then like I think with the Brilliant Stars, from what I understood, is they reintroduced a lot of cards that weren't in print for a while. So that's
there's four Charizards supposedly.
Something like that. Yeah, there's some other characters that haven't been in any of the last couple sets that are, you know, really driving the market. Some people were saying like they're buying boosters for like 120 and they're actually profiting by selling the singles. So that's why there's been so much of a demand for the boxes, the booster boxes.
Yeah, I think we sold out like 800 a case. So what's that for?
Less than 120, 120
somewhere in that. Yeah, I think they were around 120 on them. So I guess it's been pretty fruitful for that you know, that market. Now, what do you have anything? What do you think about music cards? Like as far as like alt cards, I know the Jay-Z rookie card kind of really went up, and then Justin Bieber I think has a card that does
set.
Well. Yeah,
the whole Panini set, the autographs are really hard to get. Cameron, my son, on speculation, bought a Justin Bieber auto, so we just have it sitting there. I think it's worth a lot more than what he paid for it.
And I know Carvin's been doing the stuff with The Weeknd. I'm like wondering if there's something else that could be done with music, because there's a lot of fans.
Sure.
How do they translate into collectibles?
Well, I think that's someone's got to come up with a music product and get signers and create that line of products. I think that's wide open. Someone needs to do that. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
I think the challenge is before is that I think you have to like... Like, if somebody's under Sony, you have to go to all these different record labels,
and you also have to get...
I don't know about that, though, because their
likeness... You have to get the management involved.
Yeah, it's the management. Their likeness belongs to them. I mean, also, UFC is blowing up. I mean, that's a really... Their viewership, I think, every week becomes greater and greater. They keep charging more and more for the pay-per-views, but, you know, that's something I'm very into.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, because WWE, Panini's getting that license. They're going to come out with Prism.
Should jumpstart a little bit.
It's going to be big. And then if they're able to get the older fighters into the product, people are going to want the first Hulk Hogan Super Factor.
Exactly, yeah.
They're going to... Or Gold vinyl. I'm sorry.
So, prediction. 10 years from now, do you think that we're going to have the same amount of collectors, or we're going to have more, or we're going to have less?
If it's not more, Fanatics will be bankrupt. If it's not because they paid such a premium for... I just trust them. They're not dumb. Like, they, if you want to know what the truth of something is, follow the money. These guys have put an immense amount of money in. And, like, I hate to keep going back to what Josh said, but if you listen to his words, like, we're partners with all the owners, all the leagues, all the player associations. Everybody owns this. We're all vested in growing this. Like, everyone is on the same page, which is something that we've never had in this industry. One thing, going back to Topps Series 1, the other reason why I think it's doing well, it was in the back of my head, is if you think relative, where can you chase something as valuable as the Wanderers are at a whole case rate at $1,500 for a jumbo case? Like, where, or $1,600 or whatever it is. Like, where can you chase that value at that price point in this hobby? You can't.
Right.
So that's another reason why I think it's driving it. Sorry,
getting a hobby, that's a good point. Getting a hobby box for $100.
Yeah, where are you getting it?
Yeah, it's.
But do you think the pop report, I mean, that thing is going to be massive.
Because the rating's so expensive now. So I think that controls it at some level. Like, I don't know that
least for the meantime until
I think they should always leave it allocated in a sense, right? They should never open it up where you can send those $10 cards in anymore, right?
Someone will.
Yeah.
Someone will. There's a market for it. This is still, it's still America, and you're still gonna have someone. We haven't had someone who the public wants to, the collecting public wants to assign or give the mantle to. You are going to be a reputable grader and will accept, you know, things at that boat, but it will happen. Look, remember, when we started this, BGS had a massive monopoly on grading.
Yep.
And PSA was... And how did they enter the modern market? $6 a card, $5 a card, bulk, send us as many as you want, and look what they, you know...
It wasn't that long ago when Beckett slabs were basically the gold standard.
Yeah.
And like you said, PSA was, if you had a vintage card, you'd go PSA, but everything modern would go through Beckett. It's great. And it just completely, it seemed like it almost flipped like overnight.
But
like,
what I'm saying is that
that's a good point. When they were doing like $5 cards, right, $5 submissions.
History always repeats itself. And I don't think that PSA is immune to that exact thing happening again. What's to stop BGS from expanding their manufacturing capability, because they're losing, it seems to me, even though they still have such a backlog, they're losing collector confidence, I think, is what they're
losing. Well, what about CSG hooked up with eBay now, right? They're going to be starting to do a grading through there, so...
So someone is going to fill that lower space. Maybe it won't be a $5 a card, but relative, if PSA is charging $50 a card, and someone comes in and is willing to do it for $18 a card or $16 a card, look, it's not costing them $16 to look at your card and put it in a slab. This is not.
Yeah, right. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think PSA just leased a huge building in
Jersey City. Yeah.
So they're definitely thinking about ramping. They're going to go back to ramping everything up and, you know, hopefully getting through this whole backlog, and maybe at some point we do see like a $10 economy submission that may take 6 to 8 months.
See, I think the CSG though, like, because the fact that you can sell your raw card and then it goes to CSG, I think at some point they're gonna be like $10-$15 to grade this card, and as a consumer you're gonna be like, well, why not? You know, I gotta wait for it anyway.
But
you know, so you're gonna start seeing higher pop reports on those cards that might start swaying those scales.
I think, again, we want to focus on a positive collector experience. I think it's better for the hobby if more cards are graded. Because now you have transparency, you have something, there's less fraud, you have something customers buying, they know what it is. So it would seem in the best interest of the hobby, and that if someone filled this whole weird thing where, like, I'll pay the extra $15 to grade it, why not?
Right. Well, I like their authenticity, because I've caught myself bidding on one of those LeBron SPs because I'm trying to bid on it last minute, and you don't realize it's an RP. Well, now it would, hopefully they'll catch that when it gets filtered. If somebody does think they're getting a real card, and it would get filtered out through them, and then you'd get a refund, and you know, it stops those guys from trying to do fraud, right? So it's a good thing overall.
Which is important for
the old RP at the end of the eBay title.
It's terrible, man.
Terrible.
Gets you every time.
Or just even the like the ACOs, like they create their own autographs.
Yeah.
It's not even licensed, and then the people are bidding, and they start them as an auction.
Did you see this guy on Etsy that's making the fake slabs? This is a new thing. Like, literally fake slabs with the reprinted card inside it. I mean, they're kind of, if you're in our position, easy to suss out mm-hmm. as a fake, but I don't know if it's someone in the public, if that's so easy for them.
Right, especially if you're new. I mean, if you're new or you're buying it, like say somebody's mom's buying it, they don't
right.
know these things,
you know? Patrick Mahomes, RPA for $100, PSA.
Yeah,
10.
I mean,
sounds great.
I think there's
terrible.
I think there is a market for those like custom type of cards, but like you were saying, they should be just set up as a buy it now.
Right.
They're on eBay. And don't let it go to auction to where the average consumer may not know. They may actually think they are getting
the
a LeBron
yeah.
SP Authentic, like rookie auto, and it goes up to, you know,
$20,000,
and they're like, I got a pretty good deal. And then you're like, well, it's a reprint.
Yeah, it's fake.
Yeah.
And, then they put that in the slab, and then you, I mean, the average consumer would probably have no idea.
Exactly. Well, I have a real big problem with the whole, like, and I see Whatnot doing it with PSA, is having the on-card stuff signed and then authenticating it. I'm against that because that allows somebody else to start making fakes and then getting them graded. Like, I'm seeing people getting Prism signed in, like, blue pen, Justin Herbert, Mosaic, same kind of thing, having them signed live and then getting them authenticated or slabbed. And, like, people are paying premiums. Like,
yeah, they're almost going for the actual rookie auto.
Right, the pack pull yeah. Prism.
Well, how
right?
about that change? Like, that I never thought I'd say. How about the change, like, how the, like, let's say Justin Herbert, like, we have the gold non-auto and the gold auto. I mean, I would always think the gold auto would be so. It's not really the case.
No.
Yeah,
it's not really the case.
We talk about that all the time. We also talk about how Contenders football is, that used to be, like, the standard rookie that we would want, the Contenders rookie ticket auto. Now it seems like collectors want just a silver rookie, like a Prism rookie, over like
right.
the rookie ticket.
Yeah, more so.
But I think, you know, you're also starting to see the collectors get more hip to what they did with Select football, right? Because it's like they made retail the first year, they made so much of it that the rookies have just dropped significantly because they made, I mean, the field levels aren't even worth it anymore.
You
know?
Level, you have Premier level, you have Concourse level.
But even the field levels don't sell for what they used to because they put that in retail, mm-hmm. right? So I think you're going to start seeing people go back to autograph versions eventually.
It's built in scarcity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about that earlier. Like, something gets value when it's scarce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what makes it collectible. And if you're not going to create scarcity, then you have a situation where they're just running, you know, just throwing out as many as they can.
Exactly. And I've always said that is it, what really protects us are those guaranteed single color relics, because there's not an unlimited amount of, like, those jerseys that they're going to put in there. So that basically prevents them from running the presses and just making a million of every single card.
What really gives you an idea, like a litmus test as to what could potentially actually have value mm-hmm. going forward. It's like, okay, these things have scarcity. There's no... game-worn jerseys are just not an unlimited amount
right,
of those assets that they can put into these cards. So that, you know, and the autographs and the numbered cards. But, like, going back again to Top Series 1, like, how many Wander Franco's are there? Like, how could that card really retain serious value? But the numbered ones will.
And that is definitely something we've seen in the last, like, 2-3 years is products coming out that are not guaranteed autographs.
Well, look at Hoops and Donruss now. It's like, half the autos, right? It used to be two. Now it's one in Hoops and it's one in Donruss.
Yeah, and then you look at, like, the Prism Team All and the Prism Choice.
Yeah, no auto.
No auto.
Well, one in any case. Like,
Yeah.
So
that just allows them to print more. I mean, almost a part of me is like, maybe we should stop buying that stuff so that they stop making it and creates more scarcity. But
if we don't buy it, someone else is going to.
Exactly.
Our days of where we, with our purchasing power, like, there was a time, think about it, there was a time where probably 5 or 6 of us, just with our collective purchasing power, could probably, not that we
move
ever
the
did,
needle.
But
yeah.
could probably have said, look, we're not buying this. We were too stupid to do it at that time. We probably mm-hmm. should have been a lot more friendly to each other back then, but we could have probably dictated a lot of what happens, because regardless of what anyone says, we, even the old shop owners that criticize us, even still today, there was some of that. It's like, we were the first people that took this hobby from where it was to the next level
right.
where it is. We're the ones who, we had, like you said, no roadmap. We're the ones who made that first advance and created demand that did not previously
exist. Everybody
exist.
Who is enjoying, like, crazy margins right now, I mean,
he's about to say you're welcome.
Shops did not embrace group breakers.
No.
Fruit baskets at Christmas. Like, yeah. Seriously.
It took a long time until you basically started seeing products going triple, quadruple, 5 times the amount that they were selling for before. It was because we were breaking it.
Correct.
We were getting it in collectors' hands, and they wanted more. So
I remember we would get products where we were probably at par or losing a little money.
Yeah.
We had to create margin by making the break. You know, that, like...
And it's funny that you brought that up, because that's really... That was the roadmap of group breaking. It was trying to create, like, we couldn't just get boxes and match blowout. We would make $8 on
the box. They were undercutting everyone at that time.
So we would make, we'd sell
a box. That's why a shop wasn't even in the plans back then.
You'd
like,
sell a box
no
of Topps triple threads for $180, and your cost was like
$165, $169.
After you ship it, you're losing money. So that's really where group breaking started, because we were like, how do we add value to the collector? And how do we make a little bit of money? And our company was built on a 20% margin. So, like, when the margins went through the roof, it was,
we just pulled that one out the window. Like, we have permission to make more money.
Yes. Yeah. But, and that's basically the one thing that I tell any new group breaker that's coming in. I'm like, try to figure out a way to sustain your business with a small margin.
Yeah.
Because anybody can sustain your business with a huge margin. That's easy.
Not going to always be
but
there.
But try to figure it out so you're going to be sustainable if the market does change.
When the market changes. The one thing constant is change in all things.
We're still recording there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe we are, yep.
Camera died. Talking too long.
Sorry.
No, we're good. That was fun. I was gonna say the last question I was gonna ask is, like, you know, obviously the pandemic jumped everything up. People were at home. They rediscovered their hobby. Do you think if there was no breaking in this mix and the shops just contained on, do you think Fanatics would still be buying all these licenses?
That's a big question. Like, no breaking ever?
Like there was never any breaking, and it was just shops, business as usual.
No.
Pandemic happens.
No, the hobby would never have accelerated. We were the initial accelerator of this. It's not disputable. We changed the way. We started this, like you said, how did you start? I saw this one time. I mean, this is going to change the way cards are collected forever. And it's funny. We met Mike Blumenson at GTS shortly after we started doing this, and I was so excited, and I was so full of enthusiasm, and I told him, we're going to change this whole hobby, everything, and he laughed at me, and I said, why are you laughing? He goes, this hobby has been the way it is for 30 years before you're starting. It's likely to be this way for 30 years after. He said, because change is slow and it's the same old people in control of this hobby. They're always
were. Yeah.
He was right, because
the first
5, 6, 7 years we were doing this, there really was no change.
No.
The first year, we took space. I actually traveled to the National with Gelf. We had become friends through this too, but we took space. I spent a stupid amount of money taking space on the corporate floor directly across from Panini, introducing breaks to people, educating people. They wanted nothing to do with breaking.
What National was that?
It was 2013, Baltimore one, right?
No, Chicago.
We were there. I remember that.
We set up on the court floor. It cost a lot of money.
You guys had a big, giant TV.
And it was like that, a TV in the National.
Yeah.
I was too ahead. But we were trying to put the message out there. And the only person that got it was Mike Berkus. He pulled us aside afterwards. David and I pulled us aside to explain this more to me.
Yeah.
He goes, because this has got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, they did the breaking pavilion and everything. But, like, it's the manufacturers at that time, and it's not the current management of the manufacturers now. The management of the manufacturers wanted nothing to do with breaking at all.
They weren't sure of it at all. I mean,
we were ostracized.
Remember they were trying to talk about programs for even Topps was like, we're gonna have breaker programs, and then they didn't even talk about it anymore.
But remember the industry summit after that, where they locked us in a room? They put us in a toilet separate from the rest of the store owners.
We were the stepchilds, man. Even like some of the shops like finally came around, but you know, it was just like, somebody said today, there's like, the reason I don't get allocations is because of breakers. And it's like,
it's still the belief. We're still the villains. It's like, you are eating because of what we did.
Yeah, and really, it's not the breaking. It's whoever spends the most money gets the product.
A lot of them are selling the product to breakers. So yeah, they may be getting less allocation, but they're moving one product, and it's the margin is the equivalent of what they used to sell getting 10 cases.
Yes.
If they had any margin at all.
Yeah.
Of one box, you're making way more than what you were making.
So, I mean, they're moving it instantly. I mean, we buy from shops. You guys probably buy from shops.
Sure.
Look, more gift baskets we should be expecting this holiday season.
More gift baskets.
Right? More gift baskets.
Exactly. I agree. Exactly. I mean, and you see it. I mean, I think like all these content creators, like Aoki, when he jumped in, they all, I mean, whether they found our videos or somebody else, people went to YouTube to see these break videos to understand what it was about understand what cards were coming out or how you would buy the product. I mean, if there wasn't any of that, I don't think that happens during the pandemic. You know, there's none of that.
There's
content out there.
It's not on the plate to go to the next level. And look, the one thing I will say, like there's like, I don't know if you guys are like, Polwax is a kid I've been mentoring through this. He's far surpassed anything I've done. The kid's a nonstop worker.
Yep.
He's, you know, really smart. And these kids have the knowledge of social media and these platforms to take what we did and take another
level.
They're definitely
doing,
like, they're not just taking what we did. They're taking what we did and making it better. Mm-hmm. Take it to the next level, and it's admirable. I mean,
you know,
I'm a big fan of his, and I, you know, any words of wisdom that I can give him or any young collectors or young people that want to enter the business, I'm always free with my advice. I always have been in advice dealing with cards and advice not I'm not one of these people that's hide the ball.
Exactly.
I've always tried to help people if I'm able to or have knowledge or ability to, but a lot of these younger breakers are now helping us. Like, we're kind of riding their coattails because they're the engine for this latest.
I mean, I remember multiple summits, and I think we did one at the Topps conference where we actually did a seminar for shops, and we're like, we're going to teach you how to do group breaks. Like, you guys need to embrace it.
Yes.
Don't be mad at us. Like, we're willing to basically. I remember I was telling shops, I'm like, let me know when you guys are free. I'm like, I will fly down there and I will basically show you how you need to do this. Because I know at that point, I'm like, I know you want it to go away, but it's not. So you're going to have to embrace it.
Yep.
Or you're just going to get passed by.
Adapt or die was the term.
Adapt or die, yeah.
And so, now I feel like to some degree we're in that situation now.
Yeah.
Because if without understanding TikTok, all these different social media channels, I feel like we're in that same predicament right
now. You guys do a TikTok at all?
I need Cam to get onto that because just like I can only
on
do
the
so
dance
much.
Moves, I think. I think it's all about dancing.
Or your lip syncing.
Yeah.
Or your lip syncing ability.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, I try to edit like some clips on there, but you know, it's funny. We've came from like the widescreen is whatever, but now it's like, no, it's this way. Now it's vertical, right?
Because
it's viewable on the phone now. So it's like all these holders you can buy and stuff are all for vertical. So I'm like, but no, I want to film it this way so I can put it on my put it on the TikTok, right? So it's like, it's almost like as a society, in a sense, it's became like lazy. Like, I can't even turn my phone anymore. I got to have it just in front of me.
Someone will come out with software that
auto-formats
it around.
For
whatever
format.
Someone is working on that, I'm sure, right now.
Yeah.
To fix that. But yeah, I feel like we're in that situation in a little bit right now with just the acceleration of social media and like our ability to understand.
Well, it's crazy that I don't even remember what the evaluation was, but I think Whatnot's evaluated at like $1.5 billion or something.
Wow.
And without even the sales figures I've heard don't even add up. Like the amount of sales don't even add up because they're considering it users, right? Our business, we don't really, I mean, we have an app, but we don't have users like they do. So it's crazy in a sense when you mentioned this, maybe some have passed us up, something like that has.
But it's crazy the evaluations you're getting through this whole industry.
Oh, I know.
I mean, wasn't it like Alts or Star Stock or something like that? It was like $500 million?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, people are looking at the potential. But one of the things with Whatnot, you know, when they're onboarding these people, they're encouraging them. Remember, these people are largely buying these boxes at retail or buying it from the distributor at above retail with the promise that they'll someday get allocation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then they're going on and then Whatnot's encouraging them to do the things at auction, start them at $1. They're losing money.
Yeah.
So how long the market has...
I love what you just said there. The promise of maybe getting allocation.
Yes.
What's happening?
Because it is. You're 100% correct. And it's...
Like, I love my distributor. Do not get me wrong. I would go to the end of the earth for GTS. I love it.
So do I. But we have that conversation all the time. When we buy aftermarket and we're paying a little bit above retail, it's that kind of promise to you that...
Promise to protect the little allocation.
Like, you... Yeah, if it's almost... For lack of a better term, it's almost like basically telling you, if you don't play this game, your allocation that you're getting will shrink.
They have said that. It's not veiled.
Yeah.
Like,
but see, but they're also saying that there's new guys. This is why I've
been spending $1 million a month.
Yeah, but they're losing money. So like, but how long is that sustainable?
I believe in the market. I am old. Look, my gray hair is coming in, but I believe in it. Look, economics has worked for the history of mankind. This is a small sliver. And like you said before, if the market changes, when the market changes. Because this can't... Remember, we are in a very unique bubble right now. Not a bubble I'm worried about bursting, but a bubble where you had an immense amount of capital infused into the economy. Yeah. So there's a lot of free dollars running around. And people can, for a while, sustain. Remember, if they're getting money for free, they could sustain losing money for a while. But how long do you keep doing something if you're not making
money? Well, and that's what I worry about. I mean, I know us on this podcast will be fine, but like, I worry about like the guy that's maybe like been doing it for 5 years, he's slowly growing, but because he's not able to spend the million, he goes out of business too. So now you lose the guy that's losing money, and then you lose the shop because you're not giving him any either. So now you've just lost two because you burned the one guy.
Then we may go back to the point where you can just call up a distributor and just get whatever you want.
Right.
I don't know that the distributors will be here.
Yeah.
I don't, look.
At the very least, they're going to be condensed, right? I mean,
Change is coming. I mean, look, another thing they could do to expand the collector base is internationally. You know, we're always looking at like a domestic product, but these are international sports.
Yeah.
All the big boom sports, soccer, F1, wrestling, you know, music, these are international concepts.
Yeah.
So there's a much larger collector base.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, so that's another interesting thing. I mean, look, I think we could talk all day.
Yeah, we should probably get back in there at some point, right?
I'm happy to come for another guest appearance.
Well, Larry, tell people where they can find you at, man.
We're at 100 Northwest 82nd Avenue in Plantation. It's pretty obvious. We've got league logos all over the windows, so it stands out like a sore thumb. You can find us, and always happy to help or talk to people about cards, sports, legal stuff, anything you want to talk about.
And if I'm looking to get into a break.
Oh, it's livecasebreak.com.
Awesome. That's awesome.
You guys are live 7 days a week?
We're live about 3 days a week.
3 days a week?
Awesome.
Okay. And you guys break baseball, football, basketball.
Yeah, I love the rookie and prospect mix.
We just brought that back.
Nice.
We just brought back rookie and prospect. Because also, we're building a break. The cost of things, building a break that's affordable.
I know.
What was the product? Was it Bowman Sterling Asia?
That was our joint baby.
Oh, yeah. That was awesome.
The whole product.
Dude, I missed that one.
Such
man.
A good product.
What did we pay?
Oh, man.
We were breaking that in divisions at $35 a spot. Those were the days.
I remember. It was us. We had the exclusive.
Yeah.
But it was back then where like they would ask us, can you take more product, please?
Yes. Yeah. Take it all. Yeah.
For half of what we paid Topps for.
Yeah, there was that, and then there was Bowman Platinum Asia.
Yes.
That we had.
That one was really good, too.
What about, 50, what about Bowman 15 Bowman Regular?
Yeah.
That was another one. Like $40.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was 14. Because I remember that Bowman Platinum Asia, I think it was 14, and it had the Chris Bryant, the true first.
No, that was Inception.
Oh, yeah, 13.
Okay. Inception.
Yeah. Inception.
No, one of the Bowman Chromes had the refractor versions, I think.
Right. The 14 Bowman Chrome had, I think, the 13 in it, and then the color, and I think you could get the regular one in Inception.
Okay.
Or something
only
like
the base.
It wasn't in the product it was supposed to be in. It was not in 13.
So now we're going to go up in the Wayback Machine since we're talking about this, and I love having this conversation about this specific card. What Chris Bryant card do you view as the true first Bowman?
The 13.
The 13.
Awesome. It's a 13.
Yeah, I agree.
It is what it is, just because they put it out later.
Yeah.
And I kind of like when they do that. They did that with Conforto, too. He just didn't turn out to be as good.
Right.
I like that because you're putting in extra content that you know is going to be a hot chase.
It's just the thing that sucked about the 13 is that none of the cards have the first Bowman logo. So then the 14 has the first Bowman logo on it.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to get a true response from Topps on why they didn't put the first Bowman.
Well, technically, it was the first. I don't think he signed those 13 cards until long after.
He previewed his Superfractor beforehand, and people thought he was going to be in draft. So I had people buying the Cubs before the checklist came out, thinking that he was going to be in there, and he wasn't. But the whole 13 mystery was that even Aaron Judge, no first Bowman. It doesn't say first Bowman on it.
No, none of them do.
So I wonder if that was the Chris Bryant effect.
Matt Olson, I think, is in there.
Matt Olson,
yeah.
Yep.
or it was just the design. They didn't want to put it on that design. I don't know why they didn't do it.
Like the 14 came out. It really was his first Bowman auto.
Yeah.
But it's not his first Bowman auto.
I like the 13 better too.
Yeah. I like.
It's a nicer car too. Yeah.
But if you talk to Ivan, Ivan is a 14 guy.
So. We had that super factor.
You still have it?
We know we ain't sold it. Oh. We had it at one of the nationals.
Yeah, I love having, especially having conversation with people who've been doing this for long enough to go back and be like, remember that? Simpler times.
Yeah.
Simpler times for sure.
it's crazy. I mean, look, now they're going through this whole thing with the Wander Franco. My answer is always the market will decide.
Yeah.
The market will decide. I always go back with the Brett Favre Stadium Cup rookie. I mean, that's a second year card.
Yeah.
But that's his most valuable
card. I believe
card.
The 91 is the Atlanta one.
Yeah, personally. But the most valuable one is the
92.
Well, and recently with Vlad Guerrero Jr., they had his rookie in Series 2.
Right.
But people view the update rookie as the true.
Yeah, and didn't the Series 2 not have the numbering on the back or something like that?
Yeah, but we have that in a lot of the update rookies are the most valuable, you know, base card.
Well, because update's not part of a complete set either, right? So it helps the scarcity a little bit too. So
the market will decide on all these things, and the market will decide on this latest rash of issues that we're faced with now. The market will regulate it.
Yeah.
Well, cool, Larry.
Better way to close it out than the old Chris 13 Bryan
saga.
Thank you guys.
All right.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in, guys.